Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why does a college education cost so much these days? And might there be other ways to prepare young people to lead productive lives? Total student loan debt hit $1.2 trillion in the U.S. last year. The average student borrower takes on a little under $27,000 in debt, but 1 in 10 leaves school with more than $40,000 to repay. And all this is happening as schools continue to hike tuitions and also to compete in a sort of arms race of adding academic programs and fancy facilities, hoping to draw the kinds of elite students who will increase their national rankings. So how did we get here? Filmmaker Andrew Rossi examines that question in his new documentary, Ivory Tower. It opens June 27th at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. Andrew, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So college tuition rates have risen by, this is amazing, more than 1,100% since the late 1970s. What did you want to understand about where all that money is going?
Well, I think it's one of the most stunning statistics in Ivory Tower, the fact that the increase in tuition is more than the increase in the cost of food and healthcare and housing, and indeed many multiples over the rate of inflation. What we see is that the decline in state funding to public universities particularly has been a great driver, but also student loan debt has made students the bearer of a subsidy to universities. And in many ways, they are building and providing for an array of amenities for students to attract their student loan dollar, and in the process, making tuition grow even higher. So it's a sort of complex calculus that is part of a set of different causes that have made tuition go up so much in the last 30 years.
One of the things that people may not realize is that because loans are available, because if you can't come up with the tuition out of pocket, you can borrow money, there's actually less of an incentive for schools to sort of compete on a cost basis.
That's right. Clayton Christensen, who appears in the film and is the founder of Disruption Theory, he says that all of the competition is on the basis of who's better in the rankings or who has the student center or the football stadium or all these other things that are attractive to young people, and not on the basis of price, which in so many other industries is really the distinguishing factor between one product and another.
So public universities are still often much less expensive than private ones, but they are by no means like as financially accessible as they once were. Can you talk about how the ratios of public dollars to tuition dollars started to shift over the past few decades?
Yes. Teresa Sullivan, who's the president of the University of Virginia, says in the film that for every dollar that's gone down in state funding, they've had to raise the tuition by a corresponding amount, and I believe that ratio is 1 to 4. It's clear that state funding is one of the main drivers for the increase in tuition, but we see this taking place in private universities as well. So there are other factors that are influencing this, including a shift in the public's and politicians' view of what is the value of higher education itself, and a sense that it's really a private good that accrues a wage premium for those who get a BA, versus a sense that it's a public good that the state should support in order to produce more educated citizens for a democracy.
So it's just about different ways of looking at who benefits from that investment.
Yes. We see a proud tradition in this country of government supporting the franchise of education being extended to more people, with the land-grant universities that were created in the 1860s, the GI Bill, the Higher Education Act of 1965 that created Pell Grants and federal student aid. But in the 70s, we see a shift with conservative governors like Ronald Reagan to a belief that the state should not, quote-unquote, be subsidizing intellectual curiosity. And it's at this point that state funding goes down and tuitions really start to skyrocket.
I was surprised to learn that Pell Grants now only cover about 42% of tuition for students who receive them.
It's true. When they were first created, they covered, in some cases, more than 100%. They were more than enough to cover the cost of tuition. But because they have not been funded more to keep pace with inflation, they now only fund about 40%, as you said.
Okay, so let's talk, Andrew, about what college means in America. Most students do not attend Ivy League schools, but the essential model of how a university should operate has been Harvard for 300 years.
Yes, we see how Harvard, in a way, created the DNA for higher education. It created an aspiration among universities to constantly grow better and bigger. But one of the distinguishing characteristics of Harvard is that it has this massive endowment, about $32 billion, which allows it to pursue these campaigns to grow larger, but to still offer financial aid. Indeed, they are among the 1.25% that offer full need financial aid. So they're able to have students who can't afford it to go to their school and to cover their costs. In contrast, we see in other universities that are in a similar sort of pathway to grow are passing that cost on to the student directly.
And Harvard has also set a model for having like a vast number of different degree programs that it seems like other schools that are not as elite but maybe perfectly fine schools are following suit.
That's exactly right. We see that the research university is the model for higher education that has the most prestige associated with it. It is the leader in the sector. But there's, I think, a valid question to be asked. How many research universities do we need in this country? And particularly when it's so expensive to run a really complex research university that's almost like a mini city, as it's described in the film, do we really want those kinds of campuses all across the country because they're so expensive to sustain? That's the question. Should individual students all be directed to these massive, very complex universities?
Talk a little bit about this whole prestige factor. We have the U.S. News and World Report ranking. Now there are a number of other publications and places that do these rankings. What do schools get out of being at the top of the charts?
Well, I think primarily they get a better draw on the students. I think parents and students, one of the first things they look at when choosing schools are U.S. News and World Report and other rankings. These are key to admissions at schools. As much as we wish that students were looking at different metrics, for example, completion rates or average amounts of student debt or employability after graduating, rather frequently, who's ranked on the top is of metrics that can be academic or can in fact be soft things like who's got the nicer student center or in some cases literally, who has the better food on campus.
And what are schools doing to maybe manipulate is too strong a word, but to give themselves a leg up in those rankings?
Well, it's interesting because, all of this is a lot of bad news, and we don't want to hide that. But on the other hand, there are many universities that are doing a fantastic job, and so it's important to look at those examples too, and we explore several in the film. But I would say that the attempt to not address this problem head on is in and of itself a way to sort of hide the problem. So I'm not sure certainly not to say that there's manipulation involved in that per se, but I just think that there needs to be more conversation in this country about how the financial model of nonprofit universities is unsustainable.
I was really interested in, it's almost a theory that you put out there for how it is that a lot of big, high-quality state schools end up with this party school reputation, and that a lot of that has to do with facilities.
It's true. We looked at a study called Paying for the Party, which was done by Laura Hamilton and Elizabeth Armstrong and released in 2013. What it really targets is a culture on campuses that allows for partying to become a central student activity and actually attracts out-of-state students to a given school. And of course, given the drop in state funding, when schools are able to benefit from more out-of-state students attending, they make more money because the out-of-state students pay frequently double than the in-state students. I think, again, this is a question of sort of ignoring the problem or not addressing it head-on. In some cases, this culture is spawning many problems on campus. For example, sexual assault and alcohol abuse, we see more and more being talked about, you know, on the front pages of newspapers and by President Obama. That's just, you know, one of the many symptoms that come from a sort of party culture that is, in many people's estimation, out of control.
It's an interesting contrast in the film, Andrew, because you have a number of students who are either have graduated and are struggling to find jobs to pay off their loans, or you have students who are really worried about how they're going to pay for things, administration's worried about how they're going to pay for things, and then you have scenes of students who seem to care only about, you know, getting drunk and being by the pool, including, it looks like you shot some footage at UT Austin.
There is some footage from UT. That's correct. UT Austin, and there are these websites that capture party footage and are part of this sort of celebration of the party culture on campus. And so we see from those partying taking place at a range of universities. It's not even possible to sort of pinpoint just one. This is happening all over the sector.
Is that a new thing, though? I mean, I went to college 25 years ago, and there was some partying going on along with the studying.
It's absolutely right. I mean, we see, even since the days of Animal House, which, you know, was a film made in the 70s, but looking back on students in the late 50s or 60s, this idea of the school as a social playground has existed for a long time. But I think what Richard Arum notes, and he wrote the study Academically Adrift, this is producing ever more pernicious effects in the classroom. And in fact, he says that the classroom has become a sort of theater for the exchange of favors because the students, since they are paying so much money, they sort of feel like they are consumers. And the university, growing more and more like a big business, is creating incentives for, in some cases, professors to do research and to focus more on things that don't involve teaching the actual students, but rather projects that accrue prestige to the university. So what Arum has found is that the amount of reading and writing that's going on in the classroom has declined. And so the academic outcomes for many students are actually getting worse. And this is something that I think is different even from the Animal House days.
So, in other words, it's once you get into that school, it may be hard to get in, but some schools may be requiring less rigorous work from their students in order to graduate.
That's right.
My guest is director Andrew Rossi. His documentary, Ivory Tower, opens June 27th at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join us in this conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Andrew Rossi about his new documentary, Ivory Tower, which opens June 27th at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Andrew, I was stunned to learn that 68% of students enrolled at public universities fail to achieve a four-year degree within 4 years.
That's right. And over the course of 6 years, that number is 44%, somewhat better, but still very troubling.
So why are they not finishing?
You know, I think that there are a range of factors that play a part. One of them is student loan debt. Many students who are taking on a lot of debt, if they have difficulty with coursework, start to get scared that they may not be able to basically succeed in their time in college, and then drop out in an effort to stop incurring more debt. Of course, the difficulty there is if they do drop out, they still got even a modest amount of debt, which can haunt them for many years to come.
Right. Even if you don't walk away with a degree, you owe that loan back to the government or whoever else.
Precisely.
And Sallie Mae, which is the government arm of the student loan industry, earns a tidy profit for itself.
Yes. Sallie Mae is a private company, but it's the largest servicer of federal student loans and I believe also of private loans.
Mm-hmm. And so there's no incentive necessarily to change the system from the people who are making money from it.
Well, unfortunately, that's right. I mean, those are corporations whose bottom line is to create shareholder value. And so, you know, you can't sort of expect Sallie Mae to have the interests of the debtor in mind. However, President Obama, in his recent executive action, did several things, including making more students eligible for an income repayment program that caps monthly payments to 10% of income, but also stresses that middle companies like Sallie Mae should create more incentives and should try and direct student debtors to pathways like this repayment program that might be better for them in the long run.
So there are some alternative models out there. You have a fascinating portrait of a school called Deep Springs College. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, Deep Springs, I think, is a remarkable program. It's located in the desert of Death Valley. It has a small group of all-male students, but these students are working on the ranch where the school is located. They are literally milking the cows, butchering the meat. They are governing the school and choosing the professors and choosing what they're studying. And it's a great example of students who don't feel like customers, but rather feel invested in the administration of their school and are working hard to keep it afloat. It's also free, which is a remarkable thing. It was founded in 1917 by L.L. Nunn, and it is supported by a trust that he created and also alumni donations. Of course, it's extremely small, so it's not clear that this is a model that could scale all across the country. But what we see is that the learning that's taking place, the humanistic learning, the exchange between students and faculty, is a great example of what higher education can be in this country, and indeed is in many places, but in some places has lost sight of that goal.
A lot of the drama in the film comes from the fact that you were, it has nothing to do with your presence, but there was a 65-day sit-in at another once free school called Cooper Union in New York City.
Yes, Cooper Union was a school founded by Peter Cooper in 1859 with the mission to be free for a range of students, at that time mostly working class people in New York City. Now it has an architecture program, an engineering program, an art program. Unfortunately, the school went down a path, a financial path of mismanagement that is extremely regrettable, because they took out a $175 million loan to build a new engineering building at a rate of about $1,000 a square foot, which is akin to a luxury hotel. And as a result of a deficit that they have trying to pay the mortgage back on this loan, they have now decided that they have to start charging tuition to their students. So it's the ultimate expression of this corporatized model in higher education that has resulted in schools losing sight of their mission in order to grow bigger and better, but not in a way that's better ultimately for the bottom line of the student.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Andrew in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. I have essentially two questions. One is, what is being done to fix the problem? And you mentioned a little bit about the Death Valley School. And number two is, how can project-based learning be integrated to help solve this problem?
Sure. So in terms of solutions that are being pursued, there are important state-based initiatives and some federal ones that are providing relief for students who are being crushed by student loan debt and the cost of college. We see an attempt to allow student debtors to refinance their loans the same way that those who hold auto loans or mortgages are able to refinance. And that is an initiative that's taking place in Wisconsin, in Massachusetts. And, of course, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts tried to pass legislation to that effect, but it didn't pass the Senate. It's nonetheless a great model, again, for state-based initiatives. In terms of a broader solution, you know, there really isn't one that's being presented right now. And, unfortunately, I think the political climate is such that a legislative mandate to do that, which is on the order of the Morrill Act, which created the land-grant universities, or the GI Bill, or the Higher Education Act of 1965, there's not really the mandate to get that to happen. And one of the things we hope is that the movie Ivory Tower will create greater awareness of this issue, and perhaps in time that kind of redesign could occur.
There's been so much excitement around the MOOC movement, right? Massive open online courses. And you deal with this in the film, I think, in a really even-handed way, sort of explaining what the possibilities are and also what the real hiccups have been along the way.
It's true. You know, when we first started making the film, we hoped that massive open online courses, or MOOCs, would present, you know, one important direction in terms of a solution, because the promise with MOOCs is that you can have videos with lectures that students watch, and then quizzes that they're taking all online, and sort of leveraging social media in order to have peer-to-peer interaction with some great courses that are being videotaped at some of the world's top universities. And even though that promise persists, what we found is that in pilots, particularly one between Udacity, which is a MOOC provider, and San Jose State University, which is part of the California system, when these classes are provided to some of the students who need the most help, particularly in remedial classes, and there's no human instructor involved, the pass rates are abysmal. Unfortunately, it seems clear that students who have remedial needs really they need the guidance of a professor, of a human being. So in that sense, the idea that MOOCs could solve the problem of access to education for non-selective admission students doesn't seem like it totally works, unless you have this human component. And so what we actually see is that in Bunker Hill Community College in Massachusetts, the flipped classroom model is very successful, and that's basically where the students watch the videos at home, but then they come into the class and they do their homework with an instructor.
And it's not limited to students who are of more modest means, maybe more modest academic backgrounds, because you have a great sort of dramatic foil in all this is this introductory computer programming class taught at Harvard, where hundreds of students gather, I guess, nightly to receive additional instruction.
Yes, this class, CS50, Computer Science 50, is now the most popular class among undergraduates at Harvard. It's an example of how computer science is the new sort of literacy in many people's estimation. But it's fascinating that here in this pool of some of the most accomplished young students who are taking a computer science class, which, as one student says, could be delivered almost entirely online, they still are gathering nightly to go over their problem sets, to get help from teaching fellows, to get help from the professor. And it's a real testament to the enduring power of human interaction in education.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Kayla in Louisville. Hi, Kayla.
Hello. You brought up earlier about students feeling more like consumers and treating universities as big business, and I was just wondering if there's been any look into the end-of-semester student reviews that are put on instructors and their teaching styles and classes that help bolster that shift, because we're given reviews to review the instructor and how well we think the instructor did, and we're given the impression that if they don't perform very well, at least to their supervisors, to the academic heads of their department, that if the class doesn't perform well, the two students don't feel the professor performs well, and if the pass rate isn't good, that particular class and possibly the instructor don't come back.
That does come up in the film, Andrew.
Yes, Kayla, thank you for bringing that up. That's a big part of a section in which we look at sort of how classes have become academically adrift. And we see how websites like Rate My Professor, they allow students to comment on the professor's performance, which in theory should not be a bad thing. But frequently what the students say they're looking for is a very low course load. And so when they are challenged in a way that they think is too much, the professor gets a low rating. And so in an attempt to keep up with this rating system, frequently professors are reducing the rigor in the classroom. So this is a terrible sort of dynamic that's emerged in this corporatized setting.
This doesn't come up in the film, but I wonder if you think that's partly the reason why, you know, maybe a quarter of a century ago, a bachelor's degree was enough to guarantee that you could get into most fields. These days, a lot of people are saying, no, you really need to go on to get a master's degree. I mean, have we just dumbed down undergraduate education to the extent that you have to have a postgraduate degree as well?
That's a really great point, and sort of mission creep, as it were. The idea that many universities are actually encouraging students to get master's degrees is something that is troubling for many people, especially those who then have to take on more debt at a higher interest rate on the graduate level. You know, I think that there are a couple of different factors that are influencing more people to get master's degrees, and part of it might be related to a diminution of skill sets that are actually obtained in the undergraduate context, but it's also, I think, because competition has increased, because so many more people also have entered the franchise of higher education, more people have BAs, so to distinguish oneself, having a master's helps. So it's a combination of factors, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have John on the line now in Denton. Hey, John.
Hey. Hey, Andrew, really nice to have you on here. I've got three college-age children and one that, you know, will be in a few years. But we homeschooled our kids for the first, you know, like elementary school, and then we lived overseas. Anyway, my question or statement is that I've got one that actually started a private school in but my other two, all three of them are taking gap year. But the question is I'm just not sure even if it's worth, they're still debating whether they're going to go to college or not. And my question is it, how much is it worth?
Right. Well, that's the key question, right, that everyone's asking. Is college worth it, or is it worth the cost? I think it's important to look at a couple of data sets. One is the fact that median lifetime earnings for those who do have a BA or a college degree versus those who only have a high school diploma, the median lifetime earnings are $1 million higher if you do have a college BA. So on average, it is clear that getting a college degree is a good thing. You will make more money. And certainly you'll be eligible for a mass of jobs in the middle class that require a BA. However, for those who aren't certain that they want to go and might actually not complete, they may not finish their 4 years, it's important. I think a gap year is an excellent thing to do to really sort of determine exactly what one wants to get out of college and if indeed college is the right choice. And there are many programs, some of which we explore in the film, that are part of this un-college movement. And so you could take a gap year and cobble together a set of mentoring programs and courses online that would support some period in which college and the sort of four-year brick-and-mortar experience are not exactly what you're doing. It's not for everyone, I think, but it's a good alternative.
We should be clear that the un-college movement is not the same thing as like waiting tables in Aspen for a summer or a year or 3 years. This is students who are really, they turn out to be quite self-directed and self-disciplined.
That's absolutely right. And it's also important to clarify that, for example, Peter Thiel, who's the founder of PayPal and has been encouraging people through his Thiel Fellowship to drop out of school and start a company, that whole movement is something that can be of value for students who have entrepreneurial visions and are, in many cases, extraordinary young people. But Peter Thiel in the film, Ivory Tower, actually admits that his program doesn't really have bearing for either disadvantaged students or those who do not have some extraordinary plan. For students like that, it's still the best bet to actually get a BA.
My guest is film director Andrew Rossi. His documentary Ivory Tower opens June 27th at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Andrew Rossi about his documentary Ivory Tower. You can see it starting June 27th at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Matthew, who asks about whether the extra cost to students has to do with an increase in the number of administrators at big schools.
Yes, we've actually seen that administrations have increased since 1980 by about 240%, while faculty in that same period have only increased by about 50%. You know, as these universities are growing larger, the physical plant, the facilities for them to manage is much more complex. Also, government regulation in that period has increased, and they have more to manage to comply with certain regulations. But it's a troubling development because it shows how much money is being put into things that don't necessarily have an impact on the everyday of the classroom itself.
Overall, administration roles are growing faster than faculty roles.
That's exactly right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Anne's on the line now in Dallas.
Yeah.
Hi, Anne.
I'm trying to hold on.
Anne, are you with us? Okay. Anne was curious about, I can summarize her question based on the summary I received. Why are we letting students borrow money when they can't pay it back?
Why are we letting students borrow money? I think that that's one of the quandaries that we face, yes. You know, many students and their parents, in fact, are filling out FAFSA forms and not fully understanding the obligations that they're getting themselves into. On the one hand, the Higher Education Act of 1965, which was part of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, created the federal student loan system to allow those who were, in the words of Lyndon Johnson, poor, to have access to college and to higher education. But that system has sort of gotten out of control since 1965. It's become an alternative form of subsidy for universities, and all of the sort of burden is being placed on the student to pay back that money, and in some cases, it's not right. There's lots of debate about the student loan system. Is it a crisis? Is it not a crisis? And I think that there's room to accommodate different opinions. But I do think that one thing that is certain is that college in the 60s, particularly in public universities, used to be much less expensive, and students used to be able to have a job over the summer to pay it off. And now, because tuition has become so expensive, debt is so much more a part of the calculus of going to school, and that's not, I think, what our society really should aspire to.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Charlie on the line in Highland Village. Hello, Charlie.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I certainly agree with the last statement. I mean, the student loan system now is just a subsidy for colleges. I wanted to go back. You were talking about the differences between lifetime salaries between college and non-college jobs. And I guess I was wondering how recent is that study, because let me tell you, my son graduated with an engineering degree, and he's making a huge salary. But you graduated from a liberal arts degree, there's no jobs out there for those graduates. And you know, it may be a disservice to graduating high schoolers to just tell them that, well, go to college because you'll make more money.
Does it depend, Andrew, on what you choose to study and where you invest your career time?
Well, certainly certain majors do lead to professions and employment that can be more or less lucrative. If you're taking on debt in order to become a doctor, that's a different proposition than if you're taking on debt to study a humanities discipline and in fact maybe even want to become a professor at some point. But I think that as a society we don't want to prescribe young people's options and choice. That's one of the unique things about the American educational system or higher educational system. It's supposed to provide 4 years in which young people figure out what they like and have a sort of bridge between adolescence and adulthood. But I think what needs to be a part of the equation is when students are choosing the school, that they're choosing it on the basis of what they want to study or what general area and what sort of currency a given school has in that area, what kind of jobs people get in that area when they graduate, and how much student loan debt they have and what the completion rates are. And that's what people should be thinking of versus, you know, which school has the more popular football team or which school has the better student center. Study what you want, but then go to the school that's got the right tuition rate and debt amount for what you plan to do with your life or think you might like to do.
How transparent are schools about that information? We had shows in the last year or so about law school in particular, sort of not letting students know exactly how many of them might be employed after graduation. Is it the same story for undergraduate education?
I think that information is available, but it's not completely transparent, and the universities are not handing it out as they should, at least in general. There are exceptions to that, and even within a university, there are certain things that they may be proud of and release, but then there are others that they don't. You know, the Department of Education is trying to make these metrics more salient in the process of parents and students choosing schools. And so I think that they're planning to make this required But unfortunately, the Department of Education is suggesting that this should all be part of a new ranking system. And I think there are valid concerns about trying to package that information into rankings. So it's a little bit of a complicated situation right now before it gets fully ironed out exactly how these metrics can be made available. But I do think that there are one caveat to that is that there are some important data available on the Department of Education website. So that is something that parents and students can look to.
Tell us about your website, because you've put together a pretty robust site to accompany the film. What can people find there, and what's the purpose of it?
Yes, so Participant Media is one of our co-distributors, and Participant is the company that released Food, Inc. and An Inconvenient Truth and Lincoln. They have put together a website that can be a resource for various things, for initiatives on the state or federal level to try and improve the system, with more content for those who are interested in issues surrounding those who are adjuncts or those who are students. It's a website that's at www.takepart.com/ivory tower. And Take Part is the social action arm of Participant Media.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Elizabeth on the line in Arlington now. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I attend two colleges right now, a university and a community college, and I've calculated the tuition of the university is about 8 times as much as the community college, and the facilities aren't as nice, and there aren't as many resources. So I'm just wondering, is that simply because of research at a four-year, or is there something else there?
Well, that's I don't know the specifics of which schools you're talking about, but that sounds very much like what we've seen, which is that community college is frequently much less expensive than a state school, and it can provide an excellent path for 2 years to get an associate's degree, and then allowing a sophomore to transfer in as a junior into a state school. Community colleges, as Anthony Carnevale in the movie describes, always struggle with less resources and make the most of them and pass on less cost to the student because they know that those who are attending don't have the same ability to pay.
How serious is the move to sort of reconsider the traditional model of college, meaning you go off and live somewhere for 4 years or whatever it takes and study? I mean, people have questioned this for a while. Is anybody really saying we need to just blow this model up?
Well, I think that the MOOC entrepreneurs and the sort of visionaries who from Silicon Valley who are kind of a part of that movement, that is exactly what they were saying. We see in the film Michael Staton, who's a venture capitalist in the education space, talking about how you can unbundle the college experience, looking at it as a transfer of skills, a credential, and a network of peers, and the sort of question of why do all those things need to be together. Unfortunately, I think some of the drop in enthusiasm surrounding massive open online courses has shifted the conversation yet again. And so the sort of dominance of the four-year brick-and-mortar institution has remained. But there are those who are thinking that it just doesn't make sense in the future.
We have an email here that says, has anyone raised the point about how states dramatically reduced subsidies over the past decades that used to keep tuition low? Our state support at UT Arlington, it looks like, is about 20% of revenue. UT Austin's is around 12%, so the burden falls to the consumer.
That's exactly right. State funding is a crucial part of this, and because it's gone down, it's one of the main factors that tuition has gone up.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go. We'll take one last call from Ann in Dallas. Hi, Ann.
Hi. My husband and I will be front row seating at your movie on the 27th. I cannot wait to see your movie.
Thank you so much.
My husband is an adjunct professor at SMU in the School of Engineering. And I was just kind of taken, I've just heard some of this, these comments. I'm just kind of taken by the fact that do you need the grads, do you need the master's degree, do you need, you know, do you need to push on to the master's? He is encountering, he only teaches master's classes, and he is encountering students who are just bent on dumbing down the course load. They seem to, they have to graduate, they have to get that B. They will not, they just seem like they will not fulfill the course load.
So it sounds like it's about, for some students at least, Andrew, it's about the piece of paper rather than about the educational attainment.
Yes, it's true. It's that credential that sort of provides the entry point to so many jobs in the middle class. But we have to ask, you know, what is really happening in the classroom, and is it worth this incredible amount of money that's being spent?
So somebody at the beginning of the film makes the point that the United States historically has sent the largest, has created the largest percentage of its population as college graduates. Is that likely to change in the future, given these realities that we've discussed?
Well, it's interesting. We actually see that the demand for college, the amount of people who are applying, goes up pretty much every year. There may be some fluctuations in there, but there's no sign that demand is abating. And part of that is probably due to the fact that loans continue to be so widely available. It's just one more reason that we feel that the spiraling cost is unsustainable, because it doesn't have any signs of slackening.
Did anything in your reporting give you cause for optimism?
Cause for optimism. I think that technology is a remarkably effective tool for those who can concentrate, particularly those typically who already have a BA or have, you know, extensive higher education experience. The MOOC is something that can be very powerful. It can be a part of lifelong learning when those who are further along in their careers want to make a shift or need to get a promotion and need to learn a new skill. I think that the improvements in the MOOC delivery will benefit many different types of people moving forward. And I think there's also optimism in some of the student activism. We were talking before about the students of Cooper Union. They did a remarkable thing in protesting the institution of tuition at their school and in occupying the president's office for 65 days. And I think there are other groups like Higher Ed Not Debt that are advocating for change. So I see a lot of hope in what they're doing.
Filmmaker Andrew Rossi directed the documentary Ivory Tower. It opens June 27th at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. Andrew, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Yes, Chris, thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.